Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and Blog Talk Airline. It's me, Wayne Klingman, with the Milwaukee Mob, a Made Man production. And I have to tell you, I am so blessed this evening because stopping for a few minutes with an extremely busy schedule, we have Christian Cipollini on the air with us tonight, a man who has lately been identified as the best modern writer of the mob history in the United States, and I think that's true. I'm glad to have him on the air because he's such an intelligent man. He knows, if I may say so, where the bodies are buried. So with no further ado, let's welcome the famous, the also-good, very good-looking, the man that's going to break me if we ever go to Vegas, I give you, Christian Cipollini. Good afternoon, sir. How you doing?
I'm doing well, Wayne. As always, you leave me speechless with your compliments and flattery. No, really, I appreciate that. It's actually humbling in a kind of weird way.
Well, I mean, I have to tell you, you know, I have your books, and I read what you say online and stuff, and I'm amazed. I mean, truly, I mean, I'm blessed that one, you had the time to give me to come on there, and the information that you have, you know, the information you freely share, it's incredible. I'm absolutely fascinated by that. So, catch us up. What have you been doing lately?
Lately has been a lot of behind the scenes kind of work. Like anything, that it's like the stock market. You go up where there's the years or months where you're in this field, you're doing speaking engagements and traveling around. That was last year. Very busy, awesome, got to do incredible things, go incredible places. This year was the polar opposite, where it was almost entirely behind the scenes work on different projects, some that are coming in the near future and some that were just starting. But it's as daunting or more daunting than jumping around in airplanes and going different places for speaking engagements or even sitting and penning a full book. It's sometimes more daunting. But a lot going on.
It has to be. I mean, I'm sorry. But you guys, you mean to cut you off.
No. Go. It is. I mean, for me, again, last year was so exciting in a way that every other month I was somewhere different doing very different things. This year has been finishing up projects on the plate, like the comic book series on Lucky Luciano. Yeah, that's finished, written. It's in the hands of the artists and editors. Hopefully seeing chapter two, issue two, coming out very soon. And there's two more to follow, and then a graphic novel that we're going to try to get out by spring of 2018. Hopefully sooner, but that's, you know, what we're looking at, and a documentary project that a few familiar names are working on. I'm going to be careful about how much I say about it, but that's been the main work this entire year so far.
Right. And let's just touch on, you know, your book writing and the book tours and stuff that you do. I mean, many people think it's easy to only write something. You put it out there, however you put it out there, then saving fortune follows. But truly, the work is never ending, isn't it?
It never ends. I think that goes for, you know, probably any field of or career or passion. If it did end, I think I wouldn't know what the hell to do with myself. But it, again, I'll use the word daunting. Sometimes it is because, you know, you research for however long it takes you, depending on the project, then you write it and rewrite and you put it out, and then you wait and see how it goes. You market it, publicity. But if it leads to something more, that's great. But if it just ended there, I think I'd lose my mind. But yeah, with the books, they did as much for me as I hope they did for anyone else. I learned from that process, the books I wrote and the things that I discovered or whatever. just led me to find more stuff, which is kind of what I made the books in the first place to do, is to sort of inspire others to dig further. If that makes any sense, that was one of my things that, that was one of my goals was, okay, if I can find this, then maybe somebody will find something else. And then you, even stuff we found out was wrong. And you, what I love about this genre is, okay, well, I'll do another one. Not to get on a tangent, but with the comic book, for example, I wrote a book about Lucky Luciano. There are, dozens of them that have already been written. I wanted to use the comic book to fill in some gaps that weren't in the book, and vice versa is what they do, a complimentary kind of thing, because we all know history does not release every little tidbit of information. Now, you can research a book for 10 years before you write it, and I guarantee the day the book comes out, you will discover something all of a sudden out of the blue. And it's not out of the blue. It's just, I don't know, it's like the universe toying with us.
That, and the fact, in my opinion, there's some things that they, who knows who they are, would like us not to know. And if they can bury it, they will.
Well, especially, a good point, especially with organized crime, any darker elements of history, whatever era, decade, period that you're talking about, the darker shades of history itself, because the people involved didn't generally keep diaries, at least, well, some did. There always seemed to be a little black book in some dead guy's pocket, but there were people then who would suppress that because their name was in it. So, to what you're saying, it's hard, and that's what makes it exciting to find pieces and try to put them together, sort of like a Sherlock Holmes thing. It is. It's multi-layered, right. Multi-faceted in any nonfiction kind of research mode. It excites me. I found my calling, I guess. I suck at everything I do. This was the one thing that got me up in the morning every morning. It put me to bed every night and get me back up, and I hope what I do is good.
I think it's absolutely wonderful, and I have to tell you, this is no shit Sherlock moment. It's great when you have that calling, when you feel you have that calling, and you're motivated as you are to write great stuff, because it is motivating. All kinds of different, be it a comic book where some young man or young woman picks it up and says, hey, this is really cool, I need to do better in school history, because history intrigues me, I'm going to pay more attention to school. Perhaps I read it and it fills in some gaps in old family history that I didn't know about. All that stuff is racks out. And any passion that has you waking up in the morning gung-ho, ready to get on the day, is a good thing. As far as it beats sitting on the couch watching HBO.
Absolutely. In fact, sometimes I wish I had more downtime to actually sit and watch TV. But then again, this is my thing, and it fills most of my time. I mean, maybe to an OCD kind of level, I'm sure some people think, but it's my thing. Like I said, I'll be the first to say I really wasn't good at very many things throughout my life. This one seemed to keep drawing me in, and I like it so much that I don't mean to sound arrogant, but I mean I'm good at it. It's the one thing that I excelled at, and I wanted to. You brought up a really good analogy. When I got into the comic books, the quiet things, aside from the ego and the publicity and all that kind of thing, when you get a kid come up to you at a booth and say, all right, I read your comic book, it made me kind of want to read a book, I don't read that many books, that really puts in perspective what I'm doing, like reminds me it's way bigger than me. It's the history, it's got relevance, and if a kid picks up a book or a comic book, it inspires them to, like you said, look into this stuff. That is everlasting awesomeness to me. That makes, that validates it. If that kind of paints the picture better. It's like a validation that I don't know, whatever I'm doing isn't a waste of time for other people. It's actually giving them something.
Right. In my opinion, as any great artist, I would include you in that category, sir. With any great artist, I think, is inspired by how their fan base, how the people who come to know their art, is inspired to do their own art, is inspired to do something else. You know, I mean, it's great to make money from it, but I think at the end of the day, many people says, well, you know, I'll do it. If I didn't get paid, I would still do it because I'm inspired because I know other people appreciate what I do. And I think that's important.
Well, I think probably, I mean, not to make a, you know, a broad statement, but I think most artists or creative types in general they do it because they love it. Money, yeah, sure, you'd love to, you know, that it'd be lucrative. It's not really why you start, I don't think. I mean, if you do start that way, I don't know that it would work. Again, I've told a lot of friends this. If I had tried to do this in my early 20s, I would have been I know I would have been a great failure because I would have been thinking, oh, I'm going to be rich and famous or something, yeah, which is, you know, even though I knew I was pretty good at writing and didn't even realize I was good at research and stuff until much later, it was timing. It happened when, you know, right before I hit 40. So that's when it was meant to be. That's when I guess I was ready for it. In a realistic sense, like you said, I did it because I loved it. And yeah, mm-hmm. you hope to get paid. But like any art, you know, people get ripped off and there's copies and every, you know. Yeah, that part sucks. We don't like the business part, but we have to. I love, and I know you and I have talked about this off air, is the Goodfellas analogy that I like to use. You know, it does get to a point where everybody, it's, you know, F you, pay me. You know, eventually get to that. Hey, look, I don't give stuff away for free. But anyway, that's the business end.
And the business end is part of it because one of the things that, be you a writer, be you a filmmaker, be you a watercolor painter, right? If that's what you do, at the end of the day, you have to figure out at least how you're going to do this so your costs are covered. You know?
Right.
And that's important. Oh, we had an explosion down the street. With the big bang you may have heard on the air, people listening, is we have a series of problems they were seeing, and the police are in the neighborhood, it seems, with flashbangs. Saying hello to different people in homes. So we might hear some more. Hopefully they don't come here and mistake my dress for someone else's. But back to the show.
Wow.
Yeah, it is what it is. It's just incredible, too, that I find it's great that so many writers like yourself, excuse me, and others, will take the opportunity to help new writers out with where you can go and find information. You don't try to hog it all yourself. You're very sharing, you're very giving people when it comes to your sources and location of people may not know are places to go to research and different ideas.
Absolutely. Again, I can't speak for everyone or the generations that came before whatever they're calling us, the, you know, new wave of true crime and organized crime writers, historians. But as you know, a lot of us are very close, and we always bounce stuff off each other, or if we have information or photographs that somebody else needs, and we try to, again, I can't speak for everybody, but I know personally that, you know, a bunch of us will mentor young writers, give them the good, the bad, and the ugly. Each other, it's without question. We help out, and everybody's very gracious, accommodating, because none of us could function without the other. It's not what people think. I love Hemingway, right? But it's not like we sit there with a bottle of scotch and just, right, you know, by ourselves locked in a hole. We can't, especially in nonfiction. I know my area. So-and-so knows theirs, and they cross over. That's the beauty of this. It's relevant today from 100 years ago. There's relevancy, and there's so much crossover. So we bounce off of each other, and get info. I don't know everything, you know, about Milwaukee. So I would talk to somebody, you know, from there if I needed more insight or a different view or, you know, that kind of thing. You know what I'm saying. But that you're right. And I'm very proud to be considered a part of these guys. I feel so grateful that, you know, I was welcomed in, I suppose.
I think what's nice too, I mean, I'm not a writer. I know I need to write e-books. I know. Don't hit me. I'm horrible. I'm horrible. Anyway, that being said, it's nice to know that there are people out there like you and others who will do that, will give guidance to people and help individuals just starting out. You know, you give them the, this is what you do first and this is what you do second, and it's not as easy as you think it's going to be, and it's not all happiness and roses. But let's bring you back. Let's go back to the ideas of true crime stuff. I have to ask you this question. It's one I should have asked you on the air the first time we had you on, but then we're only in half an hour. Now we have an hour. Is this, what is the most unique thing you found that surprised you when you started looking into Lucky?
When I started into Lucky, and that was, to preface that, anyone who knows me or about what I do, it's kind of obvious that Lucky was the one I was drawn to. And I know sometimes people are drawn to specific subjects or individuals of history. That was mine, dating back to my late teens, early 20s. I was just fascinated by Lucky and his entourage of friends. So when I decided to take on that subject in my own version, I think what surprised—I don't know if "surprised" is the best word—but fascinated me the most, that I didn't know and had never previously really seen in a book, was the tattoos. I'm just. It may not be significant in how crime, organized crime, was shaped in the 20th century, but the significance to me, besides the fact that I felt pretty good about myself for discovering the details of his ink, is that it goes to the bigger picture of when I'm asked, why do you write about this stuff? I write about this stuff because I'm fascinated by what makes people tick, because I just happen to be more drawn to organized crime, particularly of the 20s and 30s. That just happens to, for whatever reason, I'm drawn to that. But it's the same thing that always drew me into biographies or memoirs of anything, of history, politics, pop culture. It's what makes people tick. Knowing that Lucky had these tattoos and then realizing why it makes sense in the photographs where he isn't wearing long sleeves, how he strategically almost always had his hands placed in such a way to mask these tattoos out, in the reasons he later gave of why. And then to find out when he got them and kind of what there was behind them. And it also changed. It actually did have more significance in the bigger picture, because one of the tattoos in particular, and the date and reason he got it, totally threw out the window the basic garbage that history kept repeating about how he got his nickname. With the, you know, oh, he survived a ride and that's how he got the nickname. No. And, you know, as I cover in the comic book and in the book, the tattoo really, in a weird kind of way, but actually in a literal way, also further cemented how ridiculous that historically accepted theory of how he got his nickname was. It was nonsense, and the tattoos had a lot to do with that. If that makes sense. I know I kind of got off on a tangent there, but.
No, it made sense to me. Now, can you talk about the tattoos in detail or no?
No. I mean, I can, but I'd have to kill you.
Okay.
I'll talk about no, the details of
That
the
wouldn't be good, but
tattoos.
let's not then.
No, I wouldn't do that to you. But in the book Lucky Luciano: Mysterious Tales of a Gangland Legend, I divulge what I had found, and
Okay.
then
Read the
afterwards I
book. Get the
found out
book.
he, yes, and, but the comic book where I say that it kind of complements and fills in some blanks, again, history toying with us, it divulged a little bit more a couple years after the book came out. And when I had the opportunity to do the comic book, I thought, all right, here's where we're really going to fill in the rest of the blanks with the tattoos. So I think it's pretty neat. And I mean, again, it has more significance than maybe I even originally started to give credence to, but it really does have quite an effect on a lot of pop culture misunderstandings and myths that surrounded him,
Sure.
and they can be solved by the tattoos. So yeah, read the book.
Read the book. Oh, and before we got some time, let's bring out the first time. Where can we find the books at? If we get your book tonight, which we should do, where do we go and get them at?
My books are available on Amazon.com. I also, well, with the comic books, you can. I have a few copies on my website, ganglandlegends.com. I can sign those ones. You can get the digital version on Amazon and Comixology. My publisher, SethFerranti.com, and it's a joint publishing, and Stash Publishing, the comic book company, they also sell the physical copies. So digital, you can get from Amazon or Comixology. Physical copies from ganglandlegends.com or SethFerranti.com. And my books all can be Barnes and Noble. I believe Walmart even has them online, and of course, Amazon.
Outstanding. Thank you. And we can find you. We can find you on Twitter too, correct? You yourself.
Yes. Twitter, Gangland Legend. Instagram, Gangland Legend. I know, right? I mixed it up.
Mix it up.
And Facebook, Gangland Legends. It's either plural or singular. You'll find me. I'm all over social media. Apparently, I'm a publicity whore. So that's what you have to
Well,
do
you
when you're
have
an
to
indie
be.
author.
Well, no, I mean, right. I mean, the first, how would I put this? If let's say that, well, real history. I live in Racine, as you know. Close to us is Lake Geneva. And Lake Geneva used to be the hangout of Al Capone and others, right?
Right.
And I would call around and see where I could go and find research with Al Capone, where he lived and what homes he owned, and maybe go down some weekend with my wife and take pictures, right? And that's for our own generation, right? Education. Why not, right? And maybe
Right.
if I find more information, maybe share it with you because you might find that of interest, right? I
Right.
found quickly that when identifying myself as a member of Joe Blow Public, they didn't really care. It's like, well, come down here, we'll show you where the Chamber of Commerce is, we'll show you where the museum is, have a nice day. When I told them, I kind of sort of lied because I said I was conflicting, I was a writer, boy, did they want to spill their guts. And I'm not a writer, you are. And I can't imagine what they would do
You're
to
a
help you
fraud,
out.
damn
I'm a fraud.
it.
I'm a fraud. I should be a
I love
politician.
it. I love it. I just gain a new respect for you.
Really?
No, it does.
Well, I'm
At
not a
work,
writer. I mean, the
sometimes
idea
you'll
is that.
get hit. No, sometimes you'll get hit with that rare time, but it happens where people hear writer and they clam up. But most of the time, what you just did fraudulently, I'll remind you, it actually usually brings out the best in people.
I mean, it's taking the publicity horse, right? As just to use the word that you used, is Joe Blow, who might own the home that, or own the hotel that was used back in the 20s and the 30s, right? By probably be bought it from the outfit, wants to talk to people about the outfit. But why would he want to talk to Wayne Klingman, some guy off the street? He'll say, "Oh well, how neat, right? Have a nice day," going his way, versus have the attention of someone who can help him be famous, even if it's a one-off act, right? I'm not famous, but I own the hotel. You know, I own the hotel that they own. I own the hotel that they stayed in. Here in the back room is a tunnel that they may have stored booze in. You know, they get to live to that glory, and they don't want to tell Wayne Klingman. They want to tell Wayne Klingman, the writer. Or in your case, they want to tell Christopher, the famous writer. Look who we have here. Let's take the picture. Have the room for free. You know, here's some books I found. You know, here's a black chest. Do you want it? Yeah.
That sounds really good, Wayne. That carte blanche that you're just talking about, where is that? I need to get that then. Somehow I feel like I got gypped here.
You may have. I mean, people want, I've my experience that people want to talk to writers, filmmakers, and stuff. I mean, I can say I'm a filmmaker. I made films. But, you know, they want that legitimacy. They want to have that. They want to have that fame. Even again, if it's a one-off knockoff, and I think it's fascinating. But something else that you do as a writer is you tell family stories because the people may not lose them. I mean, how do I make sure that my family story is still around in 100 years if I have nowhere to share it with someone who's willing to write about it? How do I share it? I don't. It goes away when I die.
Well, that plays right back into what we talked about earlier. It's the human element, what makes people tick, and telling histories of I do believe history has relevance today, and I don't care what history you're talking about, there's always relevance, and that's let alone the history repeats itself because we consistently never learn from it, but it really does because it still goes into what makes people tick. I remember when my first book on Chester Campbell came out, and I think when I really thought about, okay, what was I doing or what happened to me when I finished writing that book, it was more of an epiphany of, and I didn't even expect this, it was finding humanity within the facade of inhumanity. And I don't mean to say facade is like, oh, well, this was the fake front. No, but it's what we see. When you hear bad guy, villain, outlaw, you know, automatically, it's you know, this polar opposite of good and evil, which doesn't really exist. And there is there humanity within some of this inhumanity? And when people write memoirs or like you said, hey, I, you know, used to own the hotel that so-and-so stayed in, they have a story. It may be a tiny story. It may be a big one, but it's relevant because it paints that greater picture that we're not talking about one person ever. We're talking about everybody that's ever crossed paths with these characters, right? I mean, that kind of makes sense a little. I don't know. Sometimes I might be talking out my...
No, it makes total sense. I mean, story, and I love true crime because when I say love, I love the genre. I think that some of the things I hear about on some of the podcasts are horrific, and when the people caught and appropriately punished. That all being said, you know, it fascinates me what drives people to commit the acts. You know, I mean, I understand why in Sid Ristey we have people selling heroin because some people do not ever have that economic opportunity. They can either starve or do something, and people don't like starving. So let's do something. In many cases,
that is a really, really good point. Nobody wants to starve. I truly agree, and I will add this though. And you and I have also talked about this in the past. The shades of gray when it comes to what's right, wrong, good, bad, left, right, black, white, all these things. There are three sides to every story. If you are faced with your starving or selling dope, there is also that thing called free will. People find it and they go get a legitimate job. And there is also, though, the other side that can sort of explain why this was easier or more opportunity at that time for this person or persons or group or whatever it is. there's arguments that are legitimate on all sides. Where I think we all kind of miss, though, is we're looking for an answer that I'm not sure quite exists the way we want it to. If I'm making any sense with this, I see things as now maybe I asked the wrong questions because you're expecting a certain straight up answer. There aren't any.
No.
You can blame like what I write about with the guys from New York and lower Manhattan, Jewish and Italian mostly, that, okay, well, how come not all of them became criminals? And the ones that did, how come they were so good? They could have been engineers. They could have been, financiers. And, they were. It's just they did it there. Now, does that make it right? No, but why did they and not their neighbors? Well, see, here's where we get into. There isn't really an exact answer. I mean, would you agree, disagree? This is how I see things.
No, you're right. No, who – would you look at – look at Lucky and the Mean Associates. They had similar upbringings, but then most of the people in New York at that time had that upbringing. Why did they go that way versus other ways? Who knows? We won't. Why? Well, what would they? If I'm a young man, and if I'm, say, a teenager in the early 20s, and I can make more money than loading beer in a truck, and yeah, if I get busted, I can go to jail, but the odds are I'm not. So I'm even thinking, where's the next case of beer I can put in this truck? That's what I want to
right.
do. The easiest thing
right.
I
where is the guy
find.
Down the street might be, hey, you know what, I got a dangerous job working iron work on some building that some industrial mogul has me doing for pennies, a day, but that's what he does, and it's weird how, one goes to the other, but it's not. I don't know. Maybe it's all just comes to free will, but what society tends to do is present. If there's anything that's black and white, it's that society presents basically two options to people in life when it comes to money. And we're talking, capitalistic societies and non, because it's still about who has the money and the power. You are given two options. You pick one of them. That's maybe the only straight up right or left answer you can pick out of all of this, right? I mean, I think the rest of it is way too gray, shades of gray, murky middle.
Yeah.
And with people like Lucky, not every criminal is the same, too. You had mentioned something on your shows and serial killers, things like that really fascinate people. And that's a whole different genre. Most of us, there are great writers and researchers to deal with that. Do some of our people borderline? Like Murder, Inc., for example. That one really took me to some thought. Wow, these guys were But generally, it across the board, I don't care if you're reading a biography of Benjamin Franklin or Al Capone, there's fascinating multi-dynamics to these people's stories. It doesn't mean you have to disagree with the choices, what they did. But it's a better understanding of human, how we adapt and change these. You said these guys adapted their own way. It doesn't mean it was right. I'll shut up in a second, but I do want to say, going back, something I had read, it was like a meme on Twitter or Instagram, but it stuck with me, and I'm going to paraphrase because I don't remember exactly. I saved it, but it said, villains, because their stories haven't been written. And what I took from that is, people are villainized or turned into heroes sometimes, but it's not always for the right – like, we don't – that's why people like me, I guess, exist, is to kind of tell all the stories and then maybe judge a little better, if you know what I mean. Yeah, because we tend to – I don't know. Don't we – as society, we quickly make somebody a hero or villainize them.
And we can change one to the other. You're so true. I mean, what's the difference? well, we also know the winners write histories, right? That's why Sherman, you know, is a hero when he could easily have been in the war criminal. I mean, we Dev State, what, Kellen, I think, was 3 miles long, 30 miles wide by 56 miles long. And when he walked through the South, there wasn't much left behind him. You know, that to me is a war crime. You know, that to me, when I served in the military in the 80s, if I would have been, if we would have been at war, and thankfully I did not have to, I served, I did not see any fighting, right? But I can guarantee you that if I would have, and we would have shot things just to shoot things, I would have been put in jail for that. You know, things, exactly. All, so many things going to who's a hero and who's not. And what I'm fascinated
right,
now
another
is
gray
that,
area.
Yeah.
You know, you took it even into another one. When you're talking groups and what your orders are and whatever club, military, group, organization, again, a bunch of individuals in one group and you're following something, where's the right and wrong? It's, you know, in ideologies clashing. And that even goes for the, you know, criminal underworld, what we're talking about.
Yep.
I just think it's a bigger picture than just what one, you know, one biopic is way more than that.
Absolutely. And why writers like you are so important, because it allows people like me and members of the public and everybody else to sit there and know more. And with more information, you can make decisions, or you can simply say, gee, I was wrong when it came to this. I was wrong when it came to that. I changed my mind. It allows people with more information to make better choices.
Well, that's what you just totally wrapped that up perfectly. I mean, I really don't even have anything to add. It is just that. It's hopefully we make better decisions based on a better, bigger, layered understanding of everyone, and not everyone was just good or evil in most cases. Don't get me wrong. I think there are definitely some effed up people in the world and in history, but it's almost like, well, I don't want to rule it entirely out. I still want to try to understand. Not that you entirely can, but even some of the worst people in the world.
Oh, but Mo, I'm so bad with pronunciation of names. Mo Segway, I would think. What member of the Purple Gang went to Vegas?
Oh yeah, Mo. Yeah, sure.
I mean, he changed his whole life. He changed his whole image. He ended up at the end of his life. He gave millions to charity. He built hospitals. He built libraries. He built schools. Right, but in his day, when he ran with the Purple Gang, there was a lot of dead motherfuckers because of him.
Well, no, that's and there's a lot. The philanthropy thing is great, but you look at some of history's biggest philanthropists, and then you find out some of the shit they did before that. But it also, we all got to look in the mirror sometimes, and which this does, even what I write about, particularly with a couple of those books, made me really question myself, like, could I do this? Would I be like that if I was in this situation? And was this wrong? Can I blame so-and-so? Was that right? Because it's easy to point the finger and say, oh, that's representative of evil. This is bad in society. These ones did horrible things, and that one did horrible things, and then this one did great things. We all have a glass house, as far as I'm concerned, at this age. And we all have a closet stuffed with skeletons. So if I can just go on my little soapbox, I think everybody ought to take a little step back and look in the mirror when it comes to the world and history and politics and ideologies, because nobody was perfect. And I think most people in societies had some nasty little secrets of their own, all of them, all of us, of us.
Who doesn't? It was the difference between, if you look at Marlansky, right? Another person, he did more money than anything else, right? But I suspect when push came to shove, he probably had to make tough decisions. We know he had to make a tough decision when it came to Bugsy. You know, what were they going to do? You know, well, he made a tough decision. It was okay with him that his friend got killed. I'm sure it was a hard decision, but at the end of the day, he made it. Does that make him a horrible person? Well, I guess it depends where he's standing on that issue. I suspect Bugsy didn't appreciate being shot, but, you know, he probably knew what he was doing at the time was probably going to get him killed.
Absolutely right. As far as most historians think, it probably would have come down to Meyer either giving a thumbs up or thumbs down. I don't think any of the rest of the commission would have. I do think it really would have hinged on Meyer. And for him to do that, you know, it was the business they were in. Yeah, it depends on where you stand. Yeah, was it horrible and bad? These guys kill each other? Yes, it was, but it was. You know, how can I say this, but it was the life they chose, and they kind of knew.
Yeah, the life they chose. Yep, absolutely.
I'm
sorry. I apologize. I cut you off.
No,
again.
Go ahead.
It goes to show that when we make our decisions, I mean, I'm a young kid. Let's say for men, I'm a young kid. I pick up a comic book. I'm watching The Sopranos. I'm doing what I'm doing, right? And I think the mafia is full of fun people that do fun things. And all is fun and great, and they can screw around, and they can do all these things, and run the drugs, and whoever gets hurt, right? And they pick up your book, right? And they read it for a while, and they read more of your book, and they read other people's books. They better come to the conclusion that you go down that path, you may not like what happens to you.
It generally is the case. The romantic element aside, I'm not even going to throw out there The Godfather and stuff, because, you know, fictional but kind of based on multiple real things, whatever. There is definitely a romanticized version of the mafia or the mob in general. It certainly hooked me. But when you get to the, you know, down to the brass tacks of it all, a good example is Luciano and his own words saying much later in life to a reporter. The reporter asked him, well, why didn't you marry that girl you love? Why didn't you have kids? And he said, because the life I chose, I knew I would either end up in prison or with a bullet in my back. And I, you know, this was him speaking, you know, I didn't want to, have a family have to deal with that. Now, was he really that concerned? Well, maybe, maybe not, but for him to put it in those terms, and he was an individual just like all of them were in it. Some of them were very heinous and sociopathic. Mm-hmm. Maybe all of them were, obviously, to some extent, but everybody was an individual, and that was his rationale, at least to a couple reporters later in life. And granted, he was self-serving in some of those interviews, but I do kind of take that one with some credibility. I think he probably was very aware, just like you mentioned Meyer, Lansky, Siegel, Costello, Luciano, Capone, all these guys, they all knew each other, they were all friends, and they all knew what the hell they were getting into. That was the be-all, end-all. There was a shitty part that was not romantic about it, but to that effect, there also was kind of a romantic part of it. If I'm the only one that says it, I'll say it. There definitely was.
Yeah.
That era especially.
It still is.
Sure.
Maybe I'm a hopeless motherfucker. I'm sorry, I shouldn't swear. I apologize. When we did my short film up, right, a couple of weeks ago, right, I dressed up because I split my figures that for that day I knew I had to do my responsibilities as a producer of the film, but that day I did everything I could do to look like a mobster, right? Because that's
right.
what the image I wanted to portray. It was fun. It was interesting. I enjoyed it, right? The money I spent, I call it an investment in me. It's an investment in the film. It's an investment of doing what I wanted to. It's all the romance. Because, tell the truth, if The Sopranos were nothing more than the bad side of what usually happens to people in organized crime, who would ever watch the second episode? Oh, look, Tony's going to jail for 25 years. Oh, look, you know, they're beating the shit out of him. Oh, look, they shot his kid because he's not able to pay him off in prison. No.
No, you're right. There is. And it doesn't even have to be fictionalized because there were elements of their lives where, hey, they didn't go to jail sometimes or got out very quickly. And now, eventually, yeah, a lot of them, you know, jail or dead, but not all. And even the ones that did the live fast, die young kind of thing, we as pop culture love to live vicariously through that. That's
right.
Sort of, you know, I can do what I want. Yeah, F the system. You know, I'm not paying more taxes, and I'll tell, you know, my boss can kiss my ass, which is great. I mean, believe me, I felt that way many times in my life. But there's also the other side of it. Organized crime, there's a word in that statement that says it all, organized. In order for something to be organized means there are rules and structure. So it's not like you're escaping. The only time you are, you're not a gangster then. You're an individual, an independent, as they used to call it, doing, you know, whatever. If you were a bank robber on your own, yeah, that's different. You're not part of a group. But basically, the romantic side of all of this has the flip dark side that, yeah, you're risking jail or death. You're working in a world that polices itself, and it's not very pleasant if you, you know, mess up.
Yeah.
Let's say.
Yeah, screw up. I mean, it's something. Let me throw this out there. We say organized crime, right? Bad guys, da da da. You can put all that stuff on them. But I bet you this. I bet you if I walked into someone's casino and I won, I got paid. I bet you if I walked on my car, they offered me next my car to the bank because they'll make sure I got my money. So I'd go home and be the biggest advertising person ever in the world. So people would go and spend their money, buy their beer from them because they knew they could be trusted, right?
Right.
The state of Illinois is so much in debt for a while they were unable to pay the lottery winners. Who in the right mind is now going to buy a lottery ticket from the state of Illinois when you may not get paid?
Wow.
Yeah, right?
I think that's a
true
testament
story.
Which I didn't even know. I'm not even sure what to say about that. Wow, I didn't expect that. And I expect the most unbelievable stuff, especially with what I write about. Like, almost nothing surprises me. You just did. It is a testament to why was it so successful at certain points, especially during the 20th century, and not at others. I'll put it like this. When the mob was at its heyday, it was because it ran parallel with the upper world. The underworld was parallel, not such a separate entity that it did cause chaos and waves, but yet it ran with it. And yeah, sure, some of that was like strong-arming into legitimate world, but it ran parallel. And because of that, it was a part of society. There were certain business things that went on that were much smoother when the mob was behind them, and everybody kind of knew this. I don't care if you're talking about the neighborhood corner where you knew you weren't going to get mugged, because if you did, you know, the guy, whoever did it, would end up, you know, in the East River, because that's how it rolled. Or if you're talking about, sure, there were kickbacks and the racketeering running every industry, but at the same time, there was also some smoothness to it. I'm not saying it was right, but there were things. And we all know, with, like, when you mentioned Lansky and Luciano and these guys, come on. I think I'll take the argument on with anybody that really every economics class in college should be teaching what those guys did right, because it was better than what was happening in society with quote-unquote legitimate industrialists who were basically legal racketeers, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Case in point, those people interested, the Chicago Tribune article dated July the 6th, 2017, is our story. The Trib has a story about how they're finally able to pay lottery winners now because the budget finally got passed. So for a while, we're unable to pay people.
Bright light.
Yeah, the bright light. The
bright light.
I was listening to a podcast called Crime Town, which is about Providence, Rhode Island, and talking about how they set it up and how things were in the 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s, da-da-da. And the guy, the voiceover actor, character, whatever, that host, was saying that the guy played, one of the big wigs, one of the big mafia people live in the neighborhood. It was the safest neighborhood in the place because everybody was telling him what was going on. He knew when the cops, because he needed to know when the cops were there, right, so he could hide if he needed to hide. But he knew what all the markers were. He knew what was hitting on the kids going to school, the girls going to school. You know, and God forbid if you're one of these old men and a young school girl trying to go to church on Sundays, you had a problem. You know, because it was his area. He took care of it because they were taking care of him. It's when government doesn't work well that that also comes to be famous, comes to be successful, because people will turn to someone who will protect them from the really nasty people.
Right, and if you fail in that, that's what, if there is a failure in that machinery of parallel societies, that's when you have people turn against you even more.
Mm-hmm.
From the upper world, as I call it, the one problem that always existed in the underworld, however, was when you're dealing with criminally savvy people, that is your business, your life, your compatriots, you're also risking dealing with someone who would turn on you because they are criminally motivated.
Yep.
You know, that was the there's always a flip side to everything, and a flip side to that. So that just, balance is not exactly easy in anything, let alone the underworld.
No, we're not, at least I'm not analyzing as deeply as we could in an hour show, but something we could definitely talk to and talk about in other shows, because it is fascinating to me of why the underworld is so successful at times when all other things point to it not being so successful. Now, for the audience pleasure and your own, there's a book called The Invisible Hook that talks about the economics of piracy with some links to organized crime. Because kind of so piracy is kind of like organized crime in lots of ways, and how it's able to function and work within an economic system that should be going out of its way to crush it. I just think it's a highly recommended book. Highly, highly, highly recommend that book.
I'll have to
as
check
always
that out.
Do,
yeah, that'd be good.
As all yours. So as we wrap up the show, sir, where can we find you online again?
My website is ganglandlegends.com. If you're interested in any of my books or the comic books, Amazon, Comixology, Barnes & Noble. My colleague, friend, and the guy who got me into the comic books, Seth Ferranti's website, SethFerranti.com, StashPublishing.com. You can find all my stuff. If you want to say hi, follow me, hit me up on Twitter. It's at Gangland Legend. Instagram, Gangland Legend. I like to throw up some neat little unusual photographs that I acquire every once in a while. And so, yeah, keep in touch, but that's where you can find me.
Outstanding. Once again, sir, I really appreciate you coming on the air and talking to me about your lately adventures and something we haven't really talked about because, well, we can only talk for an hour, is I'm happy that you've come on board Made Men Productions to give your expertise in what we're doing there. I mean, your expertise when it comes to organized crime, especially that with Lucky was gone in the 20s and 30s, is indeed a godsend, and I welcome you fully to the fold.
Oh, I am honored. I'm without words. You know how appreciative I am for everything, always from what you've done from day one, and welcome.
I've done little.
And,
I've done little. It's your friendship that means a lot, and I hope that being friends with you has helped me to do things and meet other people I never thought I would be able to meet, and I truly am, if anything, blessed for my friendship and knowing you, sir. But I must have pissed you off because as many times as I begged you to have some of the famous good-looking women that you know follow me on Twitter, they've refused to. So I know I must have done. I must have pissed you off sometime, somehow. I don't know how, but I know I have to.
No, sir. I don't know. These girls, they can be tough. They can be tough, even with my pool.
No,
you know,
I
guess that put me in my place.
No.
Because I'm in the pool.
Maybe, I don't know. Maybe I'm thinking this. I'm thinking that we have to go to Vegas and find out what the problem is.
I think only in Vegas. We might have to rent a car and go to L.A. too after that.
We may have to. It'll be hell. But if any great partnership can do such a road trip that we have envisioned, it would be you and I.
Absolutely. I'm in. Rent the car, buddy. We're going.
We're going to go. All right, everybody. Thank you, sir, for being on the air with me tonight. Again, I wish you the best in the weeks to come. And just let people know, they should be ready to have some interesting things coming on. We have some roundtables coming up that will be really fascinating as we discuss some very interesting topics concerning organized crime. And you will not want to miss these shows. And the movie that we did a couple weeks ago is in post. It's being edited as we speak. It should be out now, I'm hoping, by the beginning of November at the absolute latest. And details of that will come post-haste. With that, sir, and everyone else, you all have a great day. It's been an honor to have you on the air with us today.
Thank you again.
All right. Bye-bye. Thank you, one and all. Best of luck. And this was indeed a Made Men production. Bye-bye.